This is Catherine Hastings. Welcome back to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. In May of 2014, the Word Temple Poetry Series in Sebastopol welcomed two featured poets, Ellen Bass and Miriam Bird Greenberg. I'm going to play recordings of readings by both of those women tonight. And first, I'm going to introduce Miriam Bird Greenberg. She is the author of All Night in the New Country, which was published by 16 Rivers Press, and she was the winner of a contest which led to the publication of this book. She's also the author of Pack Blood Fever Grass, published by Ricochet Editions. Greenberg is the daughter of a New York Jew and a goat-raising anthropologist involved in the Back to the Land movement. She grew up on an organic farm in rural Texas and spent her childhood roaming the nearby creeks and caved-in barns in muslin schoolteacher's dresses that were left behind by ancestors 100 years dead of diphtheria. She is a former Wallace Stegner Fellow at Stanford University, and she has taught English as a second language in Japan, Canada, and San Francisco. Greenberg has also deckhanded on a sailing vessel from Miami to Panama, collaborated with the audience immersive performance group Odyssey Works, and ridden freight trains across the United States. She is the recipient of a Ruth Lilly Fellowship from the Poetry Foundation, a Writing Fellowship from the Provincetown Fine Arts Work Center, and a 2013 National Endowment for the Arts Literature Fellowship. Her collection from 16 Rivers Press, All Night in the New Country, although a riveting read, may not be the book to read right before you go to bed. The new country she writes of is a dystopian future. It's filled with dark imagery, sometimes terrifying enough that the likes of Rod Serling or maybe Alfred Hitchcock could be kept awake. The wind is much more than the wind. The shadows of birds are incredibly ominous. In the center of her scope is survival in a world where hope really does seem lost. And yet, we find ourselves in the end within a small circle of light, albeit changed, almost unrecognizable. I'm going to read a blurb on the back of her book, written by Bruce Snyder. Full of ghosts and lovers, roving wild dogs and disemboweled goats, Greenberg's eerie dystopic narratives unsettle us even as they console. Quite a ride, and a remarkable collection from one of the most exciting young poets I've read in a while. That is Bruce Snyder on Miriam Greenberg. And here now is Miriam Bird Greenberg.
Oh, thank you so much for that introduction, which is making me very sheepish. Figure out how to time myself so that I'm not too long-winded. Hi there. Thank you all so much for coming out tonight. I tend to be somewhat shy in front of audiences, and so often we'll spend a couple hours practicing and write things at the top of the page like, hello, as in that's when I should say it. And I didn't do that this time because my apartment building has been sort of scrambling around to facilitate some disaster preparedness training, in fact. And so, if I forget to say hello, forgive me. I'm going to read first from All Night in the New Country. And then I'll figure out what I would have written at the top of the page when I move on after that. The first poem is I Passed Three Girls Killing a Goat. Is my volume all right? Okay. I passed three girls killing a goat, shotgun leaned up against a tree, and the entrails spilling into a coil on the ground. It was hooked between the tendons of its back legs to a high branch that gently creaked, like a dry hinge busybody aunties wouldn't oil. Blood drained into a pail. You could smell it shifting with the air. And black flies landed in the shadows of things where the wind didn't touch. I dreamed I was carrying a sack filled with animals, and it dragged blood in the gravel and stained my skirt hem. You could follow my trail to the county line, where old men sat on the liquor store porch. One crooked his half arm for the bottle where the auger had caught his hand. I dreamed I was in a new country, rinsing livers under a spigot, and the men cracking black walnuts on a stone named my limbs like the weather, like none of us knew the same words. By the tree, the girls and the goat were faltering. One squatted to sharpen her blackened blade on a strop, and the men on the county line leaned back on the legs of their chairs, talking about anything, each other, spring weather, the long-haired boy scalped by a combine. And one of them swore you only plant beans with the moon in Capricorn, otherwise the fields choke up with scrub juniper. One looked intently at his left palm. His right wrist uselessly brushed the woven seat of his chair. When a wind came, the screen door leapt up on its leather hinges, which never creaked, and slammed shut. Mud daubers of the muck by the spigot blew sideways around my ankles, and inside I could hear the woman who lived with the liquor store proprietor cursing as she locked up the vanilla like she knew how to break the back of a ghost. So the town I grew up in, actually, the primary shopkeeper, this old woman named Mrs. Ridgeway, old woman by the time I became aware of her, I guess is the context, actually did have to lock up the vanilla. It's hard to forget. It's hard to forget what I ate when the waters receded. Certain earths, ashes, limestone, corn stalks, frayed fabric picked faintly away as if by mice. June bugs, mice. I craved friable china clay from a vein in the pond's berm. Ate that and took duck eggs to sell in town, though more and more the ducks bore pale, shellless eggs encased in translucent membrane. Those I tore open, cooked outdoors in a bone-handled coffee can. Disaster's stratum marked the abandoned kitchen's clappered walls and slap-back chairs, where flooding had paused for a moment, as if waiting in an orderly way water has never once done, then moved on. Hemline ravel threaded to a fine thorn, I gathered false mending, stitched gold filigree beneath the fabric folds of a jacket, in case one day it came to me to leave suddenly. Already half the country had scattered. Reedy gullies gathered left behind bedrolls, the debris of mementos too heavy to carry, flecking the fields. But thieves had emptied every barn of its turning forks and hay hooks, heavier still. Inside mine, the sun canted against an aging ox-drawn plow, a daybreak sundial for wanderers to this place inhabited by wreckage, the packed dirt floor specked with bone. Untouched by turmoil, a pistol lay dissected on the workbench, its interior coils unsprung, musculature retained in its minute landscape, even still. Oh, let's see. At some point during a reading, I said, should I read happier poems? And a couple people in the audience said, yes, yes, please. And then I realized that there was actually nothing that I could read. So I won't ask. This one is called Love Poem. I think it's a little bit essentialist, gender-wise, but it's a terrible world. The look some men have in the early morning, light slanting through the window, as if they've been born in a volcano, where the boys metamorphosed during puberty into birds. There's so much to surmise about rites of passage, but in the end, even the ones who brought back rabbits from nights beyond the brim and rinsed their bloodied hands in kitchen mop buckets wished to shrug off their bird bodies as soon as they could. Their mothers learned to speak bird. Only a little magic was necessary. You could buy tongues harvested from starlings in a war-ridden country, and a mother must learn to speak to her sons somehow. There are ways of making violence into an offering. All women grow into knowing this. Bodies verbs in the noun-filled fields of pumice rock, specked with obsidian, and the air wild until dusk, tall grass rustling with voles and rabbits. Overhead, raptors circle in the cool air. And what can I do but feel my own skin set around me as if it were fur? No, I mean, when the fireflies first appear, we'll want to paste their luminescent bodies on our skin like jewel-lit fish living in deep ocean trenches. Like the fish, we'll want to devour smaller fish. Or the wolf, smelling carefully every current of air. The thief sharpening a penknife idly beneath a tree before nightfall. Each regarding the object of his affection, gently. The caress a butcher gives the goat, the steady, swift blade that follows. Oh, what more shall I read? Oh, here's one. Well, these are all so grim. After all this, the mountainsides are empty, the crags uninhabited. Ash pits have melted to dirt beneath fallen leaves. There are no shots, no firelight, but yours. No train whistles anymore, or mail routes. No riverboats, or gasoline for chainsaws, or the dirt bikes that had hummed across the valley. No pack mules stepping carefully sideways over the rusted chassis of dirt bikes. No bullets. No hunters. No fish flashing in the river. There is no one to track you to your shelter, to steal your dog, if you had one, for food. No one to learn your name and say it after moonrise. The communiques of the mountainside are spore and paw print. They pattern the ground just beyond firefall. Without fear, the act of flight, what would you have? So I'll read a few poems now from Packed Blood, Fever Grass. And this is a slightly newer book, chapbook, small thing in terms of publication, but the poems are actually much older, and so in the sort of chronological mythology in my head of how all of these people exist with one another, these are the earliest in their Doomsday Garden of Eden. So maybe I'll read a poem called A Problem of Taxonomy. And it uses the word Wunderkammer, which is the sort of 19th century, I suppose, predecessor to the modern museum as a cabinet of wonder. And this is as scientific taxonomy was first being developed. And so things like this is as scientific taxonomy was first being developed, so you'll see. A Problem of Taxonomy. In the low dusk, swallows swoop from their bearded nests in the eaves. The evening primroses are in bloom, fragile vining flowers. And with them, the children have given themselves Hitler mustaches, yellow with pollen, are out by the mailbox, doubled over in laughter at the goodness of their good idea. Here, we have a problem with taxonomy, I tell the kids. Only postmen have facial hair like that anymore, I tell them. Credulous, they go for a walk with me. I point out the sway-backed barn where a mountain lion hissed at me from the hayloft, the farm where a certain 4-H'er had a sheep which gave birth to two-headed progeny. Like the forked tongue of the snake, the split body of a bifurcated carrot, all classed together in a 19th century Wunderkammer, these too are problems of taxonomy. The next night, everyone is setting off black cats in the abandoned motorhome, dislodging roosting chickens perched low and fat in the branches of a nearby tree. Towards home, I lure them. Tell them the one about my grandmother, with the armful of sparklers, back before fire had been discovered. And this was also when there wasn't a 4th of July, and we all used the irregular Gregorian calendar, which skipped days. She lit up a green genie sparkler, which flared up lucent, only out flew an emerald spark that caught the corner of a bedsheet, snapping in the breeze, and inched, ignited, outwards like a map of westward expansion, then ran, clothesline twine its fuse, until the whole line was eaten up with flames, smoldering into the dusk. Out howled the volunteer fire department and pumped water from the pond, but too late, our clothes were burned up, ashes, char, and sackcloth, and our bedsheets, too. That winter, we each slept inside a cougar to stay warm, or sometimes just a goat, though cougars were warmer. A cougar, the kids wanted to know, disbelieving the whole thing. Behind me, the old motorhome is engulfed in flame, and the children mutter among themselves, twirling the tips of their mustaches, which have grown verdant and luxurious over time. So this is all a story of a pack of feral country children as they learn their own morality and mortality. And I tended to think these were the funniest poems I'd ever written. And so the next one is called Brazilian Telephone. And the title of Brazilian Telephone was taken sort of shamelessly from an Edward Hirsch poem. And he took that line or that phrase from a CIA manual for torture that was used at the School of the Americas in the 70s and 80s in training right-wing military groups in Latin America. But nonetheless, this is very lighthearted. Brazilian Telephone. In the peach orchard, in an old bathtub, the children are standing someone in a bath of salt water, and one gently attaches electrodes to the nipples of the one in the bath. Out of the weeds runs one with a rescued battery from the old motorhome, which they had gotten to rev its engine like the sad bleating of a goat. If, later, anyone asks how they learned to do this, in a striped shirt one will say, "Oh, I was looking for science experiments from those old textbooks we got from the library book sale. I've been baking all day, and in a few minutes we'll start to wonder what happened to that box of coarse kosher salt I got just last week." The children are all singing some ditty from a musical, and in the tub, the one with electrodes affixed so gently to his chest is calling out, little muse of uncertainty, is calling and calling into the sundown, past the knotted trees with their hairy fruits, green and hard. "Hush, hush, don't worry," another one is saying, fingernail following a line of text in a complicated book. "I think this one is called the Brazilian telephone," one says, connecting finally, after all this buildup, the ends of two wires to the battery terminals, which, with steel wool stolen from the kitchen, they had cleaned so carefully earlier in the day. I meant to read earlier, there's a poem that I think of as my, like, I don't know what, a talisman poem called Siamancy, and I like to read it at the beginning. I'd like to read it at the beginning of every reading that I give, because So it's called Siamancy, which is divination through observation of shadows or ghosts. My usual name had left me, had gone up a panther trail, a hog path through the gap, where my great aunt lived when she lost a bunch of boys to TB. And I was out with my bicycle to find red nettle and fever grass, to get better and bring it back before my death name took hold. I had joined the church 57 times, I guess, when I was a little girl. None of it ever took. Sometimes, when I lay in bed and ate nothing but a spoonful of sugar with a little camphor, I would wake to hear my ghost walking around in the dark. "Get up right now," I'd tell myself, and I'd brew coffee on the wood stove and stay up calling him back. One time we got to fussing. By dawn he'd left. He got to where you couldn't tell him anything anymore. But soon enough, my right name would return from the hollows, whistling a tune, and I would feel my skin set true and know it was the death name that had died and was the dead one. When I rode through the chills, lost in the bottomlands, and said not a word so none would recognize my voice, just past there lay the leafless tree and the unlettered stones, the pasture wild with blackberries, and knotted around the knees of milk cows, black snakes drinking from their udders. There, my death name, sitting on a stump to pass the time. Here at the very end is a poem called Prologue. Listen, the names we give things are myths. Listen, I inhabited a narrow bed for many years until these children called my name from the creek. Out of a snake's nest, from the blackberry canes, they said Kaddish over their lost selves and climbed the hill to the house, crying my name like a band of ghosts with every step. Dripping wet, they'd turned gray as graves with road dust when they arrived on my stoop. They clattered spoons in their soup bowls like beggars with tin cups of coins. Into the attic, they howled like a fire. They ate all the canning for winter, lips stained purple, then lay beneath the goats and milked them into their dark mouths. Their clothes came to tatters. No shoes lasted on their feet. With dollar store bowie knives, they'd leave in the morning and come back at sundown, belts strung with skinned rabbits. They'd climb into my bed late at night with sacks of hot rocks from the wood stove to warm their feet. Then before dawn, they'd crow with the roosters, spilling kerosene lanterns and blessing themselves with the spill. Listen, I tried to warn them. Listen, they said in return. It's you who walked blind down the hill while mountain lions hissed your name from the gullies. It's you who let the phone ring while owls swooped to the attic, rabbits shrieking in their claws all night through the ceiling above us. It's you who let yellow jackets spin their paper nests in the mailbox. It's you who shuts the door at the voice of a ghost. I think I have one more. Thank you so much for inviting me. I feel very lucky to get to be up here and to read to all of you, and also get to sleep outside tonight up by Bodega Bay under the moonlight. I'm not sure where, so please let me know if you have a great suggestion. Well, the arrival. We spoke the same language. No, we did not speak the same language. We believed in the same gods. No, we didn't believe in the same gods. The lavender fields where we first arrived were forever symbolic to us, the scent not somnolent, but a promise of our new future. No, none of that. The boat we stepped ashore from was burned behind us. Perhaps they thought our people had only one, and if we couldn't leave, no more would come. No, it was not our only boat. But though we hoped others would follow, none did. The reeds we used to make our first bed bent easily, and we lay together in it on a cliffside with paths traced across the rock face. We snared birds in nets and roasted them on a spit. We ate greens picked from sparse rock outcroppings. We kept a torch aflame all night for protection. We slept safely. No, our fishing line disappeared from its reels, our earrings from our ears. Finally, the blankets that covered us vanished, and we woke, shivering in the inky night. The stars turned slowly around us. Night birds swept their ugly shadows across the stony path, and we waited. No, we did not have to wait. Thank you very much.
This is Catherine Hastings, and you're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. You just heard the poet Miriam Bird Greenberg reading from her new book of poems, All Night in the New Country. This was recorded live at the Word Temple Poetry Series in May of 2014. It's really an incredible book. So Miriam Bird Greenberg, don't forget that name. I think she'll be back. Up next, Ellen Bass read the same night Miriam Bird Greenberg did at the Word Temple Poetry Series. So I'm going to air the recording of her reading. It is always a pleasure to have Ellen Bass return to Word Temple. And this time she was celebrating her new book of poems from Copper Canyon Press called Like a Beggar. The epigraph is very interesting after hearing the powerful poems from Greenberg's book. It's a quote by Rilke. "But those dark, deadly, devastating ways, how do you bear them, suffer them? I praise." This is what Rilke said the poet's work is. In Like a Beggar, Ellen Bass picks up the tools of feeling and intellect, of memory and transformation, and sometimes irony, such as in her poem, How I Became Miss America, to craft poems that do just that. There are poems that allow us to kind of nod our heads in easy recognition and maybe even release a small laugh. Ordinary Sex and Relax are two examples of this. They're bits of wisdom that we may already know, but we get to enjoy in fresh language delivered on steamy trays. Besides Like a Beggar, Ellen Bass is the author of two other collections of poems, The Human Line and Mules of Love, published by BOA Editions. She is the winner of the Lambda Literary Award and co-edited with Susan Howe the groundbreaking book No More Masks, an anthology of poems by women. That was published by Doubleday and has seen a couple of revisions. So her books of nonfiction include the powerful The Courage to Heal, a guide for women survivors of sexual abuse, published by HarperCollins. That book, by the way, has sold over 1 million copies and has been translated into 10 languages. Again, it's called The Courage to Heal, a guide for women survivors of sexual abuse, a very important work. Ellen Bass teaches in the Low Residency MFA program at Pacific University. Here are a couple of blurbs from her book, Like a Beggar. Tony Hoagland says, "Observant, curious, honest, not fancy but beautifully measured and crafted, Ellen Bass's poems take on the whole cloth." And Marie Howe writes, "Ellen Bass has written these poems in service and celebration of Eros, the life force that can wake us, the weary citizens of this all too broken world. The poems know what they contend with. They don't flinch. Then they sing their joy." So here is Ellen Bass reading at the Word Temple Poetry Series in May of 2014.
Thank you, everybody, for coming. And it's such a pleasure to read with John and Miriam. Beautiful readings and wonderful to hear. So I'm privileged to be part of it. I'm going to start with, I'll move us gently from the ruin, starting with Saturn's Rings, which is kind of a mix. Some of you are probably familiar with, if you're not, you should be. The wonderful poet Frank Gaspar, who I think of as the ecstatic poet of the night, who convinced us to get a telescope. And this poem emerged from that. Saturn's Rings. "Last night I saw the rings of Saturn for the first time. That brilliant band of icy crystals and dust. Mirrors shepherding the light, collecting it like pollen or manna or pails of sweet clear water drawn from the depths of an ancient well. The gleam poured through my pupils into this small temporary body. My wrinkled brain in its eggshell skull, my tunneling blood, breasts that remember the sting and flush of milk. Saturn, its frozen rings, fire white, reflecting the sun from 1 billion miles. Maybe there's a word in another language for when distance dissolves into time. How are we changed? When we stand out under the fat stars of summer, our pores opening in the night. The Earth from Saturn is a pale blue orb, smaller than the heart of whomever you love. You don't forget the poles of the Earth turning to slush. You don't forget the turtles burning in the Gulf. Burger King at the end of the block is frying perfectly round patties. The cows off I-5 stand ankle-deep in excrement. The television spreads its blue wings over the window of the house across the street, where someone's husband pressed a gun against the ridged roof of his mouth. This choreography of ruin, the world breaking like glass under a microscope, the way it doesn't crack all at once, but spreads out from the damaged cavities. Still, for a moment, it all recedes. The backyard potatoes swell quietly, buried beneath their canopy of leaves. The wind rubs its hands through the trees. My son, who is here, is a farmer, and he worked at Hidden Villa Farm, and they had a fabulous, I think, pattern of reading a poem before they would harvest on harvest day. And so, you know, what is better than to have your kids read poems before they do important things? So I would try and look for good vegetable poems and once in a while send him one. And this poem arose from the reaction of his farm crew to Neruda's Ode to the Onion. And it's called Reading Neruda's Ode to the Onion. My son brings the poem to his farm crew, gathered with coffee in the makeshift lean-to. 7 a.m., the sun already at its green work. And they don't believe it when Neruda says the onion is more beautiful than a bird of dazzling feathers. Heavenly globe, dance of the snowy anemone. These young people bury the black seeds. Weed, water, watch over them. Then pull the fat bulbs from the sweet dirt. I've seen my son walk the rows, nudging the drip hose over the small shoulder of soil toward the stem of a plant. I say, long live their insistence on reality. May they always muddy their hands in the actual, handle the hard evidence of the earth. But if Neruda could stretch the accordion of time, he'd explain that when he says he loves the onion more than the birds, it doesn't mean he loves the birds less. When he thinks of the onion, there is nothing but onionness, translucent sleeves that give way to only themselves. When he praises the onion, nothing else exists, like nothing else exists in the center of the onion, like nothing else exists when you fall in love. The rest of the world goes silent for a while, and then the earth starts to turn again. Seasons reappear. You get hungry and want a sandwich. One day, you read a book. You may even fall in love with someone else. The great ones regard every moment like this, catch it as it swims, onion, bird, flower, fish, the way a bear scoops a salmon from the river. They love the oily orange flesh and the fins, the pewter eye, the slimy entrails, and the harp of bones. The masters eat everything right up to their death, and then they grab that too in their failing fist. This poem is called Relax. Relax. Bad things are going to happen. Your tomatoes will grow a fungus, and your cat will get run over. Someone will leave the bag with the ice cream melting in the car and throw your blue cashmere sweater in the dryer. Your husband will sleep with a girl your daughter's age, her breasts spilling out of her blouse. Or your wife will remember she's a lesbian and leave you for the woman next door. The other cat, the one you never really liked, will contract a disease that requires you to pry open its feverish mouth every 4 hours. Your parents will die. No matter how many vitamins you take, how much Pilates, you'll lose your keys, your hair, and your memory. If your daughter doesn't plug her heart into every live socket she passes, you'll come home to find your son has emptied the refrigerator, dragged it to the curb, and called the used appliance store for a pickup. Drug money. The Buddha tells a story of a woman chased by a tiger. When she comes to a cliff, she sees a sturdy vine and climbs halfway down. But there's also a tiger below. And two mice, one white, one black, scurry out and begin to gnaw at the vine. At this point, she notices a wild strawberry growing from a crevice. She looks up, down, at the mice. Then she eats the strawberry. So here's the view, the breeze, the pulse in your throat. Your wallet will be stolen. You'll get fat. Slip on the bathroom tiles in a foreign hotel and crack your hip. You'll be lonely. Oh, taste how sweet and tart the red juice is. How the tiny seeds crunch between your teeth. My wife and I were on our way to Death Valley when we, well, that's metaphorical in itself, isn't it? But we were, literally, on our way, as well as metaphorically. And we stopped in Bakersfield, California. Are any of you familiar with Bakersfield? And do any of you know the Padre? Well, next time you're there, go ahead in. At the Padre Hotel in Bakersfield, California. It's Saturday night, and all the heterosexuals in smart little dresses and sports coats are streaming into what we didn't know was the hottest spot between Las Vegas and L.A. Janet and I are in jeans and fleece, not a tube of lipstick or mascara wand between us. Grayheads, a species easy to identify without a guidebook. The over-the-hill lesbian couples of the Pacific Northwest. Janet's carrying our red and white cooler with snacks for the road across the marble tiles of the Art Deco lobby when we turn and see the couple entering through the tall glass doors, slicing through the crowd like a whetted blade. The butch is ordinary enough, a stocky white woman in tailored shirt and slacks. But the confection, no, the pièce de résistance, whose hand she holds, is of another genus entirely. Her cinnamon sheen, her gold dress zipped tighter than the skin of a snake, and her deep décolletage exposed enough for open-heart surgery. She's a yacht in a sea of rowboats, an Italian fountain by Bernini. She's the Statue of Liberty, the Hubble telescope that lets us gaze into the birth of galaxies. Oh, may they set that hotel room ablaze here in this drab land of agribusiness and oil refineries, outdoing Pittsburgh as the top polluted city in the nation. Trash it like rock stars, rip up the 300 thread count sheets, free the feathers from the pillows. And may that grand femme be consumed, right down to the glitter on her slingback 4-inch stilettos and whatever she's glued on her magnificent skin to keep the plunge of that neckline from careening clear off the curve. That was a true story. I only wish I could send the poem to that couple. I was embarrassed to look very long. But I looked well, short but well. Well, I was delighted today. Garrison Keillor read my poem on the Writer's Almanac this morning, and he makes everything sound so damn good. I can't read this as well as he read it, but I'm going to read it anyway. It's called Deceiving the Gods. The old Jews rarely admitted good fortune, and if they did, they'd quickly add, Canahara, let the evil eye not hear. What Dumkopf would think the spirits were on our side? But even in a tropical paradise laden with sugarcane and coconut, something like the shtetl's wariness exists. In Hawaii, I'm told, a fisherman never spoke directly, lest the gods arrive at the sea before him. Instead, he'd look to the sky, the fast-moving clouds, and say, I wonder if the leaves are falling in the uplands. Let us go and gather leaves. So, my love, today, let's not talk at all. Let's be like those couples eating silently in restaurants, barely a word the entire meal. We pitied them, but now I see they were always so much smarter than we were. Janet and I became increasingly concerned about the treatment of animals that we use for eating, meat animals, and we started to feel like we wanted to know the source of what we ate so that they wouldn't be raised in inhumane conditions, and the more research we did, the harder it seemed to really get a satisfactory situation. And so we were lucky because friends of ours were raising some chickens for themselves, and they offered to raise some for us. So we were very happy about that. And then when the time came for these chickens to be slaughtered, they called up and asked if we would like to help. And I felt that, and I said yes, because I thought that I should not, that I didn't want to eat things that, I didn't want to eat something I wasn't willing to kill. So this poem arose from that experience, and it's called, What Did I Love? What did I love about killing the chickens? Let me start with the drive to the farm as darkness was sinking back into the earth. The road damp and shining like the snail's silver ribbon and the orchard with its bony branches. I loved the yellow rubber aprons and the way Janet knotted my broken strap and the stainless steel altars we bleached, Brian sharpening the knives, testing the edge on his thumbnail. All 88 Cornish hens huddled in their crates, wrapping my palms around their white wings, lowering them into the tapered urn. Some seemed unwitting as the world narrowed. Some cackled and fluttered, some struggled. I gathered each one, tucked her bright feet, drew her head through the kill cone's sharp collar. Her keratin beak and the rumpled red vascular comb that once kept her cool as she pecked in her mansion of grass. I didn't look into those stone eyes. I didn't ask forgiveness. I slid the blade between the feathers and made quick crescent cuts, severing the arteries just under the jaw. Blood like liquor pouring out of the bottle. When I see the nub of heart later, it's hard to believe such a small star could flare like that. I lifted each body, bathing it in heated water until the scaly membrane of the shanks sloughed off under my thumb. And after they were tossed in the large plucking drum, I loved the newly naked birds, sundering the heads and feet neatly at the joints, a poor man's riches for golden stock. Slitting a fissure, reaching into the chamber, freeing the organs, the spill of intestines, blue-tinged gizzard, the small purses of lungs, the royal hearts, easing the floppy liver carefully from the green gallbladder, its bitter bile, and the fascia unfurling like a transparent fan, When I tug the esophagus down through the neck, I love the suck and release as it lets go, then slicing off the anus with its gray pearl of shit. Over and over, my hands explore each cave, learning to see with my fingertips, like a traveler in a foreign country, entering church after church. In every one, the same figures of the Madonna, Christ on the cross, which I'd always thought was gore, until Marie said to her it was tender, the most tender image. Every saint and political prisoner, every jailed poet and burning monk. But though I have all the time in the world to think thoughts like this, I don't. I'm empty as I rinse each carcass, and this is what I love most. It's like when the refrigerator turns off and you hear the silence. As the sun rose higher, we shed our sweatshirts and moved the coolers into the shade. But other than that, no time passed. I didn't get hungry. I didn't want to stop. I was breathing from some bright reserve. We twisted each pullet into plastic, iced and loaded them in the cars. I loved the truth, even in just this one thing. Looking straight at the terrible, one-sided accord we make with the living of this world. At the end, we scoured the tables, hosed the dried blood, the stain blossoming through the water. This is a poem from my neighborhood. It's called Walking by Circle Market Late at Night. The city is quiet, as though it cried itself out. Circle Market, its windows busy with stickers for surfboard wax and bands with names like Make a Mistake, is dark now too. Last year, the owner was held up, but he handed over the money and wasn't shot. The next day, I sealed two 20s and a 10 in an envelope and gave it to him. We went there a lot when the kids were little, popsicles and nights we ran out of milk. Mr. Song on his high stool by the cash register, presiding over the aisles, the dusty cans of Camel soup and hamburger helper, Huggies and Ajax. His body looked sunken, and his eyes jerked over to the door when he told me the man pointed a gun at his wife. She'd been sitting on a stack of Sunday Chronicles, and warned him not to reach for the phone. After that, he wouldn't let me pay for my pint of Haagen-Dazs and added an ice cream sandwich on the top. For the child, he said, even though the youngest is grown and gone. When I protested, he slipped in a Snickers bar. And when I insisted he couldn't keep doing this, he tossed in a box of Chiclets. Last summer, when my friend was visiting, I sent her instead, but he'd seen us walking the dog together and wouldn't let her pay either, sneaking in a pack of American Spirit lights and a yellow Bic. The Greeks believed every human act is perilous. I can't go in there anymore. Annie Dillard said, we all love the same things best. And so a writer should look for the things that only he or she loves. And I love repetition. This is an ode to repetition. I like to take the same walk down the wide expanse of Woodrow to the ocean. And most days I turn left toward the lighthouse. The sea is always different. Some days dreamy, waves hardly waves, just a broad undulation, in no hurry to arrive. Other days the surf's drunk, crashing into the cliffs like a car wreck. And when I get home, I like the same dishes, stacked in the same cupboards, and then unstacked, and then stacked again. And the rhododendron, spring after spring, blossoming its pink ceremony. I could dwell in the kingdom of Coltrane, those rivers of breath through his horn, as he forms each phrase of lush life over and over until I die. Once I was afraid of this, opening the curtains every morning, only to close them again each night. You could despair in the fixed town of your own life. But when I wake up to pee, I'm grateful the toilet's in its usual place, the sink with its gift of water. I look out at the street, the halos of lampposts in the fog, or the moon rinsing the parked cars. When I get back in bed, I find the woman who's been sleeping there each night for 30 years. Only she's not the same, her body more naked in its aging, its disorder, though I still come to her like a beggar. One morning, one of us will rise bewildered without the other and open the curtains. There will be the same shaggy redwood in the neighbor's yard and the faultless stars going out one by one into the day.
This is Catherine Hastings. You have been listening to Ellen Bass reading from her latest collection of poems, Like a Beggar, published by Copper Canyon Press in 2014. In just a moment, we're going to move on to Lawrence Ferlinghetti performing his poem, Allen Ginsberg is Dying, a really beautiful piece performed with music. But first of all, I want to give you a little reminder about my Poet Laureate project, Digging Our Poetic Roots. About once a month, 4 to 6 weeks or so, I've been sending out a mini essay on something that has to do with poetic craft. And along with the essay, I include a poem by any number of poets, and also a writing prompt. And I am inviting all Sonoma County residents, all ages, everyone, to write a poem based on the prompt or anything else that comes up for you, and send me a poem. At the end of my 2-year period, I'll be publishing an anthology containing a good number of these poems. And it will be an anthology of Sonoma County poets only. So once again, the project is called Digging Our Poetic Roots, and you're all invited to attend. If you would like to participate in the project, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. And if you know of any children or anyone else who might be interested, please contact me as well, okay? So we're going to move on now to Lawrence Ferlinghetti. He is performing Allen Ginsberg is Dying. Here we go.
Allen Ginsberg dying. Allen Ginsberg is dying. It's in all the papers. It's on the evening news. A great poet is dying, but his voice won't die. His voice is on the land, in lower Manhattan, in his own bed. He is dying. There is nothing to do about it. He is dying the death that everyone dies. He is dying the death of the poet. He has a telephone in his hand, and he calls everyone from his bed in lower Manhattan. All around the world, late at night, the telephone is ringing. This is Allen, the voice says. Allen Ginsberg calling. How many times have they heard it? Over the long, great years. He doesn't have to say Ginsberg. All around the world, in the world of poets, there is only one Allen. I wanted to tell you, he says. He tells them what's happening, what's coming down on him. Death, the dark lover, going down on him. His voice goes by satellite over the land, over the sea of Japan, where he once stood naked, trident in hand, like a young Neptune, a young man with black beard, standing on a stone beach. It is high tide, and the seabirds cry. The waves break over him now, and the seabirds cry. On the San Francisco waterfront, there is a high wind. There are great white caps lashing the Embarcadero. Alan is on the telephone. His voice is on the waves. I am reading Greek poetry. The sea is in it. Horses weep in it. The horses of Achilles weep in it. Here by the sea in San Francisco, where the waves weep. They make a sibilant sound, a sibylline sound. Alan, they whisper, Alan.
You're listening to Word Temple on KRCB 91.1 FM. We have a couple of minutes left, so I'm going to play an excerpt from The Orchard, read by Bridget Pidgeon Kelly. I hope you enjoyed tonight's program. If you have any comments or questions, you can contact me at khastings@wordtemple.com. Thanks for listening.
I saw the dog in a dream. Huge, white, bony creature, big as a horse. At first I thought it was a horse. It was feeding on apples, as a horse might, though not with a horse's patience, for it was starving. Its hip bones were empty bowls. The horse wolfed down the apples, without breathing, without looking up, the way a dog wolfs down meat. And then it growled, and I saw that the horse was a dog. But the apples were still apples. Windfall from the orchard above the lake. Pitiful place. The few trees there grow black and yellow, and the thin grasses stagger down to the abandoned north field, which floods in winter and then freezes. Blue ground, marbled with red and white, like a slab of meat. And when the far deer cross over it and the birds cross over it, it is as if the memories held within the meat were rising from it, or it is like flies crawling. I saw the dog in a dream, and then days later, just before dawn, I climbed to the orchard, and there he was, the same dog, chewing on a dead doe, and it was troubling. I thought I might still be dreaming, as was the case when for many months I could not sleep and I lost the power to tell the figures in my dreams from those we call real. I thought the scene might have been staged for me by my mind or by someone who could read my mind, someone who was having a good laugh at my expense or testing me in some way I could not understand. Beneath the black and yellow trees, the dog's skin seemed abnormally white, and the blood on his broad muzzle shone like wet paint. I closed my eyes, not because the ghostly creature was now biting at the neck of the doe, the way those dark creatures who drink blood and live forever do, since the river of blood flows forever, the streams of an eternal city, forever running, forever carrying their musky loads of blooming and expiring words and figures, 1,000,000 yellow lights forever flickering off and on in the black liquid, gold, sweet liquid, fallen,